Thank you for Howard. We thank you for the time he's taken to prepare this morning. I just pray, Father, you'll just open our hearts, open our minds to what you have to say this morning. I pray that Howard will truly know your presence right there with him, holding him by your right hand. And I pray, Father, that you'll just help him for the next 30, 40 minutes or so to clearly communicate what it is that you've laid on his heart. And this I pray in Jesus' precious name. Amen.
Am I working? Good. Sam said, don't put it in your pocket, that's dangerous. He didn't say putting it on my belt was dangerous. Sorted. Nearly. I made vague promises to Sam about how long this would be. They were vague. 25 past. They weren't vague. 40 minutes maximum, I said. Okay, here we go. Don't know if you're aware what you were singing in that last chorus. It sounded like a very big ask to me. Very big ask indeed, actually. Now, we're starting a series, which I think we're leaving next week, but then be joining again fairly quickly, leading up to Christmas, looking at some of the prophecies in the Old Testament relating to Jesus and relating particularly to his birth. Now, I should say, when I was asked, no particular prophecy came to mind for me, and I wasn't desperately comfortable about the subject. I chose this one in Isaiah, and I said so at the time, not really because of my interest in the prophecy, although it is extraordinary, but because of the backstory to this prophecy. It is the backstory that interests me, and it is the backstory that we'll be looking at. We won't actually reach Isaiah chapter 7 for quite a while, so I wouldn't bother turning there yet. First of all, most of my Christian life, I think as I said one Sunday morning not that long ago, I have been very comforted by the words most frequently used in the New Testament about what God expects from me. They're my sort of words. I feel they're at my level. Next slide, please, Jonathan. Language of the New Testament. We're asked to believe in Jesus, we're asked to trust in Jesus, we're asked to depend upon Jesus, we're asked to put our faith in Jesus. I like these words because it feels like they are within my reach. Words like know, be certain, have no doubts, these are more of a problem to me. A quick comment, it says here on the pictures, there really aren't many, so make the most of them when they do turn up. There's a few early on. Next slide. What's the consequence of me believing in Jesus? Well, because I believe in him, because I trust him, because I've put my faith in him, then with his help, I try to please him. I try to become more like him. I try to submit to his lordship. Using the language of Dietrich last week, I try to serve his kingdom. I seek to do his will. But belief, trust, faith in Jesus, they are the starting point. They come first. Belief, trust, and faith are not weak words. They are sufficient to motivate us to do just about anything. If you're interested in the picture, it's actually a photograph taken on a tube train in New York, I think, by a strange little group who likes pulling stunts I was actually thinking what it means to become more like Jesus and what would happen if you looked just like him. That is a tube train full of identical twins. And they all sneakily got together one day, sat either side of the carriage, just to see how people responded when they walked into the carriage. How do we cope when our belief and trust in Jesus are undermined or threatened? Next slide. Most of us at some point will find that our trust or belief is threatened. At such times, you may well find yourself questioning who God is, questioning whether he exists. More personally, questioning whether he is good, whether his love for you is real. Sometimes it may feel like God did not catch us, and we are lying on the ground, looking up and asking, what just happened? Well, what might we do if it were another person, a human being, in whom we had lost confidence, and not God? Next slide. For it to matter a lot, it has to be someone you care about a lot, a parent, a husband, a wife. One possibility is that what you would do is to start to look for evidence, look for proof. How do I know that you love me? Show me the evidence. Show me the proof. It is natural for us to do the same thing with Jesus, with God, when our confidence in him is undermined. Next slide. What did it mean to put God to the test? First of all, the questions that we were asking just now, they're not a problem. They're reasonable questions to ask. There is no shortage of evidence. There is no shortage of proof. But when things get really tricky in our lives, we would really like something more personal from God, something more intimate, something in the present. We would really like something that God would do just for me to show that he is here, to show that he does love me. This also is not unreasonable. And there are certainly many times in my life when I have desperately wanted something just like that. So when does it become a problem? What does it mean to put God to the test? Something talked about in the Old Testament, quoted by Jesus in the New Testament, something that we're clearly not supposed to do, but what does it mean? Next slide. After Jesus was baptized, he was taken out into the desert, and there he was tested by the devil. Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you are the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Jesus answered him, it is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. First of all, this is a ridiculously high-level argument. It's like hearing Albert Einstein argue with someone else. I think you should be aware with this sort of conversation that you are completely out of your depth. Nevertheless, two things. First of all, if you are the Son of God, I don't know for sure, but he seems to be saying either, Jesus, there is doubt about who you are, or he's saying, I would like to create some doubt about who you are. And also, the devil takes a promise of God and says, is it unreasonable to ask God to keep his word? Jesus seems to say, no, I'm not willing to go down that line. And the reason is something else God has said. But what does it mean to put God to the test? Next slide. I think where it feels that there is reason to doubt such things as who God is, whether he exists, whether he is good, whether his love for you is real, putting God to the test seems to include saying to God things like, if you do this for me, I will believe in you. If you do this for me, I will trust you. If you do this for me, I will obey you. If you do this for me, I will submit to your lordship. God seems to say that demanding such things is not okay. Requiring them from God is not okay. He never says that we shouldn't ask for this sort of reassurance or comfort, that we shouldn't desire it, that we shouldn't hope for it. But demanding it, requiring it, that does seem to be a problem. Which unfortunately means that when things are trickiest, when things are most difficult, when things are most confusing in our lives, we may not get from God what we would like the most. All we may hear from him is, trust me. Trust me. So, sadly, we're not allowed to put God to the test. But, Jonas, next slide. God is allowed to put himself to the test if he chooses to do so. And if we have time this morning, all I really have for you is four stories. Two from the Bible, two from modern day. All of which are connected to this issue. Two where God seems to take the initiative and almost choose to test himself. And more surprisingly, two where God does actually seem, in a very particular situation, to allow himself to be put to the test by others. Next slide. The first story, the story of a man called Ivan Moseyevich, known as Vanya. Before we come to this story, I should tell you why I like these stories and maybe why I'm reading them to you. I do like these stories. I just find them extraordinarily encouraging. They're not normal stories. Each of them is a bit of a one-off. They're not God acting in a typical way. They're God acting in an atypical way. But a very, very cool atypical way. They leave me thinking, whoa, I have never heard of God doing that before. And whether or not he ever chooses to do anything like that for me, and I'm more than happy for him to do so, I do like the fact that he did it for a member of my family, one of my relatives in Christ. Background to the story of Vanya is that Vanya was a Russian soldier in the early 1970s. He was a member of the Red Army in communist Russia. The government's policy was atheistic in the strongest of senses. In particular, a great deal of pressure was put upon those who were in the army to give up any belief they had in God. And it was in that environment that Vanya was an extraordinary witness for Jesus Christ. He was persecuted, he was physically tortured, and ultimately he was killed because of his trust in Jesus. This story takes place when the soldiers have gathered for an evening lecture at the army camp. The lecturer does not turn up. The soldiers decide to have a debate about God and get Vanya to explain and justify his beliefs. Vladimir started it off. All right, Ivan, which is also Vanya's name, who is your God? Ivan's pleasure at what looked like an opportunity to preach to the class was short-lived. My God, he began, he is almighty and all-powerful. In the middle of the room, a sergeant from Armenia coughed on his cigarette and stamped impatiently on the floor. He groaned in exasperation. Just a minute, Moseyevich. Your God is all-powerful? Yes. He can do anything. Yes. The sudden challenge in the sergeant's eyes was unmistakable. The soldiers stared in enjoyment. If your God is all-powerful, and can do anything, prove it. Murmurs of assent came from all corners of the room. Ivan's life had awakened disturbing questions in many minds, and the sergeant spoke loudly. If your God can do anything, let him get me a leave tomorrow to go home. And they were extremely rare. Then I will believe in him. Fair enough, Vladimir exclaimed. Here would be something scientific, black and white, yes or no. Leaves were rare. There would be nothing inconclusive and mysterious about a contest like this. Responses to the challenge came quickly. Yes, Ivan Vasilievich, I've listened to you. Up to now, everything you've said sounds like fairy tales. But if your God gives Pyotr Andreevich Prokhorov a leave, then we will believe there is a God in the sky. Most certainly. Let your God prove himself. Then even we will believe. Gazing at excited men, Ivan prayed fervently in his spirit. Lord, can this be from you? Will you be tested by men? What they ask, is this right, Lord? Unmistakably, the words came into his consciousness. Tell them, I will do this. Every eye in the room stared as Ivan answered. His voice had an assurance that astonished the men. Turning to the sergeant, he spoke clearly enough for every person to easily hear his reply. Tomorrow, the Lord says, you will go home on leave. For the first time, Ivan noticed that a large crowd of soldiers had gathered at the two side doors of the lecture room, spilling over into a line around the walls of the room. A stillness, like an invisible mist, seemed to hang in the air. Finally, the spell was broken by the arrival of several breathless officers. The evening's class began. Later that night, there is much to talk to you about, comrade. Ivan's voice was a whisper. Prokhorov raised himself on one elbow, pulling his blanket over his shoulder. Why aren't you asleep, Moseyevich? Ivan smiled. Because there is much to talk to you about. Since you will become a believer tomorrow, there are many things I must tell you. You are crazy, Moseyevich. Why don't you go back to bed? And you're going to get cold. You said you would believe if God gives you a leave tomorrow morning. Of course. Many of us said we would believe. But it is for you, Pyotr Andreevich, that God is going to do this miracle. I must tell you what the Bible teaches. The night wore on as the whispered monologue became a discussion. 2 hours before dawn, Prokhorov stood and stretched quietly as Ivan ended a prayer. At the sound of the bugle, Ivan awoke immediately with a thrill of expectation. This would be a wonderful day. For once, he was eager for the morning ordeal of long-distance running. Perhaps he might find Sergei and be able to tell him about Prokhorov and what the Lord had promised to do. But unexpectedly, there was to be no morning drill for Ivan. The night delivery of bread had not been made. Ivan would leave for Kerch and pick up the bread supply that would be needed for breakfast. Ivan climbed into the cab of the small truck, singing as he turned the key in the ignition. When he pulled back into the base almost an hour later, he was surprised at a small commotion near the garages where the trucks were parked. Curiously, he jumped down from the truck and ran toward the crowd of soldiers milling about the gate. They were men from his own unit. Excited shouting split the air. Ivan Vasilievich, comrade Prokhorov has left on leave. Prokhorov has gone. We've been waiting to tell you. The soldiers were gathering around Ivan eagerly. A general or a colonel had called their base from headquarters in Odessa with the order that Prokhorov be given immediate leave to go home. He had departed 10 minutes after the phone call, running and leaping like a crazy man, jumping on the back of a mail truck that was leaving for the train. Vladimir pushed to the front of the crowd and grabbed Ivan's arm. The officers came out when they saw us all laughing and cheering. We told them what happened last night at the political lecture. You should have seen their faces when we said everything had turned out as you said. Major Gudenko came out to see what was going on, and when he heard the story, he sent some soldiers immediately to the train to bring Prokhorov back. They left in a spray of melting snow, skidding all the way to the front gates. They arrived at the train station to see the very end of the train disappearing in the distance. Prokhorov was gone. God is God. He will do what he will do. Next slide, Jonathan. Story of Ahab. After Solomon had been king over the whole of Israel, the country of Israel had split in two, became Israel and Judah. Things went particularly badly in Israel. By the time Ahab was king, there was profound confusion as to who God was. Were there many gods? Who was the strongest God? Was there only one God? Next slide. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did all the kings of Israel before him. So he wasn't the best of guys. In this situation, God does two things. Next slide. Now, Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." This is surprising. In this situation of profound confusion, God says, "I am going to put myself to the test. I will prove to you that I am God. It is going to stop raining now. It will not start again unless Elijah, my prophet, prays to me." God keeps his word. For a number of years, there is no rain. And then God decides to do something even more extraordinary on the day that Elijah is to pray for rain. He says, "Let's have a competition. Competition between me and all the other gods. Let's see who wins." Elijah contacts Ahab, explains, and Ahab agrees. Next slide. So, Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves. Let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I'll call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God." Then all the people said, "What you say is good. Sounds good to me." The prophets of Baal have the first go. They spend hours getting up to all sorts of stuff, trying to persuade Baal to come down and set fire to their sacrifice. And there is a lovely couple of phrases in the Bible describing what happened. Verse 29. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Then Elijah asks for water to be poured over the sacrifice again and again until it is completely saturated. Then he prays to God, "Answer me, Lord. Answer me, so that these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." Next slide. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." The initial response of the people, certainly encouraging. Elijah then prays for rain. Next slide. Once he's prayed, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rain started falling, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. So, how do Ahab and Jezebel respond to two of the most extraordinary miracles in the Bible? Two of the most extraordinary proofs of who God is. Next slide. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." What changes? Nothing. Nothing changes. Ahab and Jezebel continue to worship Baal. Elijah runs away, afraid and depressed, profoundly depressed. It seems that there was no revival in the land. We read of nothing. And there was certainly no change in the hearts of Ahab and Jezebel. And when God eventually speaks to Elijah in the depths of his depression, he seems to say, "Yes, it is bad, isn't it? But there's still a few out there who serve me." Next slide. Not a desperately encouraging story, the story of Ahab. Is there any chance of the story of Ahaz being any better? There is one letter different in his name. Keep an eye out for it. So we leave a dodgy king in Israel and go forwards about 150 years to a king in Judah. All of the kings of Judah are measured by how they match up against King David. Had quite a lot on him recently here. And for all of his faults, and he did have a few, he was the best king that Judah ever had. Next slide. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 16 years. Unlike David, his father, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God. He followed the ways of the kings of Israel and even sacrificed his son in the fire, engaging in the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He offered sacrifices and burned incense at the high places, on the hilltops, and under every spreading tree. Not desperately encouraging. The story we're reading was from a time when Judah was under attack from Israel, sometimes called Ephraim in this passage, and Aram. Towns and cities were being attacked, people were being killed, people were being carried off. The problems were real. The dangers were real. Ahaz was inclined to go to the king of Assyria and make an alliance with him. Next slide. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken, as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son Sheer-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the launderer's field. Now that's what I call guidance, by the way. I think that's quite specific. Say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smouldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram, and of the son of Remaliah. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart, and divide it among ourselves, and make the son of Tabeel king over it. Next slide. And then this is what Isaiah tells Ahaz. Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. It will not take place. It will not happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. First of all, this is a great promise. It's the best sort of promise because it is unconditional. It does not say, if you are good, then I will do this for Judah. It does not say, if you obey me, I will do this. It says, it will not take place. It will not happen. The decision has already been made. It's also a very rare promise from God in that a time frame is included. You're very lucky if you have a promise from God which includes a time frame. They're not normal. In 65 years, God says, there will be no Ephraim, there will be no Israel. The last verse sounds like a strong warning. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. And then God adds to that something which, to the best of my knowledge, is unique in the Bible. Ahaz has real problems. There is a real danger. Isaiah has come with this crazy prophecy, and he said, do nothing. Just trust in God. God's got it sorted. There's no worry. Just depend on him. Trust in him. Do you have doubts, Ahaz? Are you not sure? What does God say next to him? Next slide. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. What's just happened? Next slide. The people of God need salvation. And they did. Ahaz, you are in danger of looking in the wrong direction for it. I am going to save them. I have decided to. It will happen. All you need to do is put your trust in me, believe in me. This is so important, I'm going to make you the most extraordinary offer. Hence the title of the sermon. You may put me to the test. You choose the sign. There are no limits. You may choose whatever you like, and I will do it. Extraordinary. Have to ask the question, what would you choose? What would you choose? I actually couldn't work out what on earth I would choose when I thought about it myself. No limits. Quite extraordinary. What do you think Ahaz chose? Finally, all doubt could be lifted from his mind, all confusion done away with. Next slide. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. What? Your first instinct is to try and think well of him. Is he being spiritual? Is he being holy? From Isaiah's response and what happened next, I'm afraid the answer is no. Next slide. Then Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of humans? Will you try the patience of my God also? Ahaz then refuses to trust in God. He refuses to obey him. And he goes instead to the king of Assyria to get his help. Ahaz's response to Isaiah, I will not put the Lord to the test, feels like hypocrisy of the very highest order. What do you think God's response was to Ahaz? Next slide. The people of God need salvation. You're in danger of looking in the wrong direction for it. I am going to save them. I have decided to. It will happen. All you need to do is put your trust in me. Believe in me. This is so important. I'm going to give you a sign. God actually makes two completely separate prophecies at exactly the same moment in the one set of words. Strangely, this seems to be something of a habit with God. Next slide. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The young woman will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. He will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. It's a prophecy about the immediate future, reaffirming the previous one. The two kingdoms attacking you will be laid waste. And there is a sting in the tail. You're thinking of going to the king of Assyria for help? Don't bother. I am. He is on his way, and he is bringing trouble. The Hebrew word translated here for young woman will conceive turns out to be extremely useful if you're trying to say two different things at the same time. First of all, from what we read later in the book, it seems that the young woman referred to is the wife of Isaiah himself, who bears a child. And before he is fully grown up, the prophecy given here is fulfilled, exactly as God said it would be. But there is a second prophecy, sneakily slipped in, at the same time. But this is a prophecy for everybody, of all times, for the whole world. Next slide. People need salvation. They are in danger of looking in the wrong direction for it. I am going to save them. I have decided to. It will happen. All you need to do is put your trust in me. Believe in me. This is so important. I am going to give you a sign. Next slide. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. The word previously translated as young woman can also be translated as virgin. And as Matthew points out, for this second prophecy, this is indeed the correct translation. And I think the most beautiful thing aside from the fact of being conceived by a virgin, as Jesus indeed would be, is the name. Jesus has many names given to him, but this is surely one of the most extraordinary. Emmanuel. His name was going to be God with us. God is with us. When Jesus was born, his name was God is with us. What a name. Next slide. One of the problems of folk like Ahaz is the impact they have on those who are closest to them. There are two big problems. If you are a close relative to someone like Ahaz, number one, because they are not good, the Ahazes of this world have a very negative impact on those closest to them. And secondly, and I think if you're a Christian, this is often the bigger issue, if you are the one who lives with Ahaz, at some point you will probably ask, where are you, God? God, what are you doing? Frequently, sadly, bad stuff is passed from generation to generation. We see it in all sorts of situations in life. So, it is extremely hard to have much hope for Ahaz's eldest son, who was brought up by Ahaz and who lived with him for many years. Who was he? Next slide. In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father had done. That's the highest statement you get of any king of Judah. It really doesn't get better than that. Well, by George, it is extremely encouraging. So let's read on. Next slide. Hezekiah removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. He held fast to the Lord and did not stop following him. He kept the commands the Lord had given Moses, and the Lord was with him. He was successful in whatever he undertook. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. It's extraordinarily encouraging that your past does not trap you. Your past can be a big problem. Your past can be a tremendous problem. Your past can put all sorts of stumbling blocks in your way. But it doesn't trap you. It does not enslave you. God is greater than any past that you might have. Now we will have the next slide, but I'm afraid it's going to be sad. Jonas. Five past 12. Time is up. This was my favourite story. All you can do is look at my favourite slide and think, what might you have heard? Maybe you'll never know. Maybe we'll hear about Steve Davis another day. Next slide. And next slide again. When it feels there is reason to doubt such things as who God is, whether he exists, whether he is good, whether his love for you is real, I don't want in any way to trivialize such times in your life. They are as bad as they feel, and they are as hard as they feel. It may well be that all you hear from God is, believe in me. Trust me. Next slide. A verse from 1 Corinthians. I chose the Good News translation for a very specific reason. Just about every other translation uses the word tempt rather than test. The two words seem just about interchangeable throughout most of the New Testament. I think tempt works here, but I think test actually works better. First of all, a warning. If you're thinking none of this applies to you, if you think you are standing firm, you had better be careful that you do not fall. Then something encouraging. Every test that you have experienced is the kind that normally comes to people. It'll be individual. It'll be personal. And yet also at the same time, it is a test that has come to many others. But God keeps his promise, and he will not allow you to be tested beyond your power to remain firm. At the time you are put to the test, he will give you the strength to endure it. And that is the phrase, to endure it. And so provide you with a way out. The discouraging thing about that verse really depends whether you're a glass half full or a glass half empty person. He will not allow you to be tested beyond your power to remain firm. He may well test you right up to that point. And then the last slide, since this was all supposed to be on Isaiah, a reminder of a surprising offer. We were thinking really about a surprising offer made to Ahaz, but actually what we really ended up with is a surprising offer which is made to us all, which is made to the whole world. People need salvation. They are in danger of looking in the wrong direction for it. And God says, I am going to save them. I have decided to. It will happen. All you need to do is put your trust in me, believe in me. This is so important. I'm going to give you many, many signs. And I think we'll be thinking about some of the signs before Christ, leading up to Christmas. There's innumerable signs during Jesus' life and innumerable signs since Jesus' death and resurrection. But one of which is today's. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us.